All right, I'd like to welcome everyone to Flexibility, the Future of Work. My name is Christine Dixon. I'm the president and founder of Foresight Management. Flexperience and I really had an exciting opportunity, I think, to pull together, you know, really five top employers that are here represented today to talk about their best practices, to share their achievements and stories with you on how they implement what we really consider today's most important talent management and retention tool, which is a flexible work environment. And I think they really do see, and we'll share with you the clear return on investment for these type of initiatives, which I think is really important for you to kind of go away with, to share with your management teams and your organizations as well. I'd also like to thank our gold sponsor, Nixon Peabody, as well as our silver sponsor, Ernst & Young, and our contributing sponsor, Precent Technologies, for really kind of believing in, I think, what we're doing in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I'd also like to take a moment to recognize the 9 local Bay Area employers who are finalists in the Alfred P. Sloan Award for Business Excellence and Workplace Flexibility, which is an award that just recently came through to the Bay Area through my business Foresight Management in partnership with the Families and Work Institute. I'm just going to go through a couple of the names. And if some of these organizations are here, I'd really like you to stand up so that people can have an opportunity to talk with you about the award process. The first company is Lee Hecht Harrison, BDO Seidman, Fenwick & West, Precent Technologies, KPMG, Cerna Therapeutics, Woodruff Sawyer, Deloitte, and Mother Jones Foundation for National Progress. All these organizations are finalists in this award, which I think is really outstanding. And then I would just like to briefly introduce you to our panelists and our speakers. We have Sally Thornton. She is president and co-founder of Flexperience, and she will be our moderator today. Would you like to stand up? And we also have Joshua Henderson from Nixon Peabody. He is a partner there at the end. Marilyn Nagel. She is the director of diversity and inclusion at Cisco Systems. Tim Stevens, who is partner at Ernst & Young.
Queensway Boston.
We have Molly Anderson from Deloitte. She's a partner there. Director. And then we have Sharon Kloon. She is the director of work life at Accenture. And finally, we have Ellen Galinsky, who is the president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute. And she will actually give our keynote address. So, we would like to get started. I'm going to turn it over to Ellen. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be in San Francisco, a little colder than New York, but one of my favorite cities, and I'm thrilled to be here with you today. I'm going to talk about When Work Works, the initiative that we have at the Families and Work Institute, and why When Work Works and why now. But let me start by telling you a little bit about the Families and Work Institute first, for those of you who may not have heard of us. We are going into our 20th year. We're a research organization. We anticipate the trends. We conduct rigorous research, and the findings either inspire or lead to action. We do the largest nationally representative study of the U.S. workforce this year. I am thrilled to tell you that we will have 30-year trends on the U.S. workforce, and we also conduct the most comprehensive study of employers and how employers are responding to the changing needs of the workforce. So let me begin with what we know from the research that we've conducted. I think of research as an adventure story. It really gives you a chance to look at what's happening, what's changed. I love nothing more than sitting there with numbers when our data begin to come in and figuring out what the story is to see what's happened. It's really exciting. When we looked at the workforce, this is based on the last time we did the national study of the changing workforce. When we looked at it, With 25-year trends, it was clear some of the changes that we all know about, that the economy has changed. It's moved from an industrial to a knowledge and service-based economy. It's fast-paced. It's fiercely competitive. It's global. Even if you don't work for a global company, every one of us is affected by the global economy, certainly affected by technology, and we're 24/7. We also have four generations in the workforce right now, matures, or whatever we want to call the older generation. I don't know if matures is the right word, but anyway, the people born from 1922 to 1943, baby boomers, who, as we know, have always changed everything that they've come into contact with, born between 46, actually, and 63, Gen X, so it would be 45, my number was wrong before, Gen X, 1967 to 1979, and Gen Y, 1980 to 1995. The workforces are also become much more diverse, more women. When we started tracking the workforce, it was 42% women. It's now 49% women among people who work for someone else, and that's virtually at parity. More people of color, from 12 to 21%, more employees over 40, the graying or the non-graying of America, however you want to look at it, from 35% 25 years ago to 56%. One of the findings that I found particularly striking, though, was about women. Women now have outpaced men in education. Before, men were always had higher levels of education than women, and the last time we looked, they crossed. In fact, if you look at those 50 and younger, there's a 9 percentage point difference between women and men. 32% of women and 23% of men have a four-year degree or more. Is that surprising? Yeah, it was surprising to me, too. It was one of those when you're looking at all these numbers and you go, oh, wow, that's really interesting. Work has changed, too. I don't need to tell you this. It's more demanding. It's hectic. It's technology has blurred the lines between when we're so-called working and when we're not. When you're driving home and you're thinking about work, are you working or are you, are you at home? If you're fixing dinner or having dinner with your family, but you're thinking about what some coworker or a boss said to you today, are you working or are you not? If you're at work and you're thinking about, oh my God, it's summer, what are my kids going to do this summer? Are you working or are you not? It's just very unclear. And there's also an expectation of an instant response. 56% of employees are often interrupted during work, and they're often trying to do more than one thing at once. Family life has changed. Among all those people in relationships in the workforce, in married or in committed partnerships, 78% now are dual earners. It was 66% in the past. More of us have elder care responsibilities, 35% the last time we looked. And I can tell you that the new data have just begun to come in, it's 45% of people who are caring for an elderly parent or relative in the last 5 years. Our definition is really strict. It means taking care of someone, helping them do things that they couldn't do themselves. So it's not just, hi, how are you, kind of a check-in call. It really is physically helping people practically helping people do things that they couldn't do themselves. And it's not just women, it's men. They're statistically the same. And it's not just older people. It's younger people as well. Men are spending more time taking care of their children. Now, we ask people who takes the greatest responsibility in families for a variety of tasks. And when it comes to taking care of and doing things with children, we listen to what the women say, because they will be the more conservative reporters on this. When it comes to who's doing the repairs around the house, we listen to what men say, because women tend to say they do more repairs than men say they do, and men say they do more childcare than women say that men do. So it's gone from 24 to 30% of women who say that that their husbands or partners are taking as much or more responsibility for the care of children as they do. Still 70% of women taking the greater responsibility, but that's a really big jump in 10 years. The time that women and men are spending, women's time has stayed the same. Men's time has gone up so that they're only 42 minutes that are different on a day when women and men are working in terms of taking care of and doing things with kids. But the real difference is the younger generation. Now, I used to think that most of the talk about generations was made up by some consultants who talked to three of their friends. Some New York Times stories are that way, too. We don't get me started on the opt-out revolution. In this case, we actually went and we looked at our data, and we really found a difference, particularly among men, in relationship to children. Younger men spend an hour more a day doing things and taking care of their children than boomer fathers. Even if you statistically control for the differences in the ages of their children, or you just look at people who've got kids 12 years and younger or 6 years and younger, any way you want to look at it, men are spending more time with their kids. So no surprise there's a time famine that most people are experiencing. 67% of people say they don't have enough time with their children. 63% say that they don't have enough time with their husband or their wife or their partner. That's up from 50%. That's where we're squeezing the time. We're taking it away from each other as adults. We're not taking it away from children, taking it away from housework, too. Women are doing less. Men are doing a little bit more. They're more dust balls in America. My children thought that they just came with houses. You know, where are your dust balls if they went to one that didn't have one? It's because we had a dog that shed, and we didn't vacuum that much. 55% say that they don't have enough time for themselves. I actually think that feels low to me, but this is the whole U.S. population. Values are shifting. Among younger workers, they're more likely to be family-centered or what we call dual-centric. That is, that they put an equivalent priority between their work and their family life. I don't use the word balance because balance implies 50-50, and for anyone who's ever tried it, it doesn't work. But also balance implies that if you give to one, you take away from the other. And that is only true in terms of time. Time is finite. But if you look at energy and you look at mood, work can enhance or detract from your mood. It's not just this seesaw kind of a notion. We call it dual-centric because we talk about an equivalent priority. It's really how you prioritize, and every day we're making different priorities in the way that we live. And younger workers are much more likely to be dual-centric or family-centric than boomers are. Now, you might think that that's bad for business. How can you be successful and not be work-centric? I mean, companies might argue with that. We're going to hear from Ernst & Young, and Ernst & Young defied convention by having its people-first initiative, by putting employees before clients, and there's the assumption that that wouldn't be good for clients, but it has been very good for clients, as I'm sure you'll hear about. Being work-centric isn't necessarily so good for work. We found in a study that we did of the top leaders in 10 multinational name-brand companies that the people who were the most successful at work put an equivalent priority on their on something outside of work and work. They were the most productive. They had risen higher. They supervised more people. They made higher compensation. We're now doing a study where we're looking at whether that emerges when you get to be the most senior leader, or whether it happens in the pipeline. So we don't fully understand that. But we found that, again, being dual-centric is good for business. On the other hand, this time famine does have repercussions for employees. We found that that fewer people want to advance to the next level. We've had the notion of a career ladder. You're going to hear very different notions of career, flex careers, I think, is the wave of the future. But we found that the traditional notion of rung a rung and a rung up and up and up, or if you opt out, you fall off the ladder, is not really the way most people's careers are, particularly women in real life. And particularly, all generations don't necessarily want to advance to a job in the near future as they used to in the past. For example, among younger workers, people under 23 years of age, in 1992, 80% wanted jobs with more responsibility in the near future. That dropped to 60% the last time we did the National Study of the Changing Workforce. Now, didn't you, that's another one of those aha findings. I mean, I had heard it because we manage groups of employers at the Families and Work Institute, that people, you could always get someone to take a job, but would it be the right person? And we found that, in fact, this was true, that fewer people want to advance. If you take people between 23 and 37-year-olds, it dropped from 69 to 54%. Among people 38 to 57, it dropped from 41 to 31%. So there's been a drop across all of the generations, a 16% drop among men, among college-educated men, a 21% drop among college-educated women. So today in the United States, we have some issues. 39% are not fully engaged in their work. 54% are less than fully satisfied with their jobs. 38% are going to make a concerted effort, probably not now while the economy is rocky, but they're thinking very seriously of looking for a new job in the coming year. 33% are exhibiting one or more signs of clinical depression. We use a standardized measure of that. And 46% of men and 41% of women are experiencing some or a lot of conflict between their work and their family life. Notice who's higher, the men there. Women's level has stayed the same. Men's level has risen. And it's not just men who have wives who are employed. There's no statistical difference, 52% of men with kids, whether or not they have a spouse at home or not. So it's among all men. I think there's a different image that men have of being fathers these days. So employers are looking for new ways to make work work. That's the name of our project, because employers are looking for ways to make work work for both the employer and the employee. It really is a different a concept. We've identified six criteria. In the first time I talked about research being an adventure story, we've identified, in the first time we looked at it, six criteria for an effective workplace. It's having autonomy in your job, learning opportunities. It's having an environment where your supervisor and your coworker help you succeed on the job, involving employees in management decision-making, and creating flexible workplaces. All of those six criteria are asking people to take more responsibility, to be more accountable for results, and they have more support in succeeding. That's the common factor, even flexibility, which may be one of the surprising ones there. We've gone on, in the latest study that we've done, The Next Generation of Leaders in a Global Economy, we've gone on to look at the whole issue of what pipeline and senior leaders want most, what are their values in the workplace, and we found, and then we've matched those with the ingredients of an effective workplace, and we found that the most important value for both men and for women is having a supportive workplace. The second most important value is opportunities to learn and grow and be challenged. The third most important value, and this was a surprise to me, is having a good fit between their life on and off the job. That's among senior and pipeline leaders, really almost no difference between women and men. Women are less likely to have their values realized on the job, and that's where that's predictive of their being more likely to leave. But anyway, anytime we've ever looked at this in our own analyses, we've found that if you work in an effective workplace, you're more engaged, you're more satisfied with your job, you're in more likely to stay, you're in better health. So it really, you can see the payoff. For example, engagement. If you look at the six ingredients that I told you about in the beginning, we found that only 3% in a workplace that is not effective, only 3% have a low level of engagement, and 82% are highly engaged in helping their employers succeed. So, what is flexibility? We have 20 characteristics of flexibility this time. We've just released our latest study. All of these are free and on our web. Please go and get them if you'd like them. This is our 2008 national study of employers. I've just finished a 22-city radio tour about this. There's a lot of interest in the new findings from this study. And we look at both flex time and flex place. We look at the amount of time that you work part year, full year. We look at career flexibility, lots of different ways of looking at flexibility. Flexibility, it is really, as we find consistently in every study we've done, very valued by workers at all levels and a part of an effective workplace. There are lots of data that show a return on investment. I'm not going to tell you the national data. I'm going to tell you the findings from our new report, which is our bold new ideas for making work work. These are the winners of the Sloan Award and the people who Christine announced hopefully will be in this book next year. We have found the most amazing things in these reports from employers all over the country. It really is astounding. We began in 2005 in 8 communities. We moved to 16 communities in 2006, 24 communities in 2007, 30 communities in 2008. Next year we'll be in 36 communities, and we're going to be statewide in a number, probably 4 states around the country. So let me share some of those ideas, we sent a copy of this book for all of you, and it really is incredible. We see this as becoming like the guide that people will go to and look for innovative ideas. Employers will go and look for it. This gets downloaded close to 1,000 times every day from our website, and it's a place where people looking for jobs will go. It really is a compendium of really great ideas. I'm going to start with Sharon. I'm going to start with Accenture. I'm not going to tell you what she's going to tell you about her workplace, but they're one of the winners. They have 1,400 employees in Dallas, and they're one of the winners of the award in this book. And it shows that there are positive results attracting and retaining employees. 83% of employees at Accenture said that the ability to manage work and family life was critical to their decision to remain with the company, and that led Sharon to do all sorts of creative things like future leave, which she will tell you about. Suspense. So what is the business case? Again, it's increasing employee engagement and commitment. VCU Health System, another employer in this book, has 7,634 employees in Richmond. We all know that the healthcare industry has shortages. They have found that they've created a lot of different kinds of flexibility. They also have a weekend scholars program so that people can improve their education. Again, we look at all the ingredients of an effective workplace, and they found that it really yields benefits. 90% are positive about their work schedule, 79% experience high levels of support for their career development plans, and 90% are willing to recommend VCU as a place to work, and those statistics are up. Capital One is another example in this book. We looked at them in Richmond, and we looked at them in Washington, D.C., and they've seen their figures rise by creating a program called the Future of Work. They have 3 different types of workers. You can work in the office in a traditional way. You can work in the office sometime and out of the office hoteling, or you can work at home or in Starbucks or anywhere else that you want. And they've seen their numbers go from 57% who were satisfied with their jobs up to 80%. 74% say that this new initiative has increased their productivity. 63% say that they're more creative at work. That's up from 39% just the year before. So pretty dramatic results just in a year. And, of course, they've saved space costs. Also reducing turnover. 1-800-CONTACTS, another employer in this book. They're 11 years old. They're in Salt Lake City. They've got 720 employees. They've moved from $3 million in sales to $250 million in sales. Most of their sales are repeat customers. And they have many, many different forms of flexibility. Half of their people work at home through a very sophisticated call system, and their turnover rate is one-third of the national average. So it really has increased retention in a business that's very hard to create return over. Reducing absenteeism and sick days, Continental, another example in our book. They have 2,000 employees in Houston. Houston has an initiative called Flex in the City. It's an initiative to you've heard about it? It's a good idea, huh? Big traffic congestion in Houston, not unlike here, not unlike New York. Our mayor in New York thought of making a higher fee to come over the bridges and to go into certain parts of New York. It didn't pass. I thought he should just try flex in the city, tell people to telework as they've done. In Houston, they found that it saved 15 minutes of commuting time each direction for those people who commuted and really did affect the environment in wonderful ways. Continental is one of the players in Flex in the City in Houston. They have 25 programs providing flexibility, an expanded day off shift where 25% of their employees have 3 days off during the weekend, and they've had a 5% annual attrition rate in an industry with a 50% norm, and they have 34% of people with perfect attendance. I'm always suspicious of that. I think people are going to work sick. But more better is that they only have 2 to 3% lost time per month. I'm less suspicious of that. What about customer satisfaction? Arapahoe Douglas Works in Aurora, Colorado. They have 80 employees. They give money to each employee to improve his or her education. And they've exceeded their government agency, and they've exceeded their standards 100% on all counts in the ways that they're rated by the government. Lots of, again, interesting kinds of flexibility. What about reducing business costs? Direct Energy in Dallas has 851 employees, and they encourage telework, and they've avoided the costs of new office build-outs. What about profitability? Well, one of my favorite examples is El Paso Corporation in Houston. They have 16 and 64 employees, and they have experiments in flexibility, but they tie metrics to it. So, and I think this is really important. The group comes up with a notion of what kind of flexibility they're going to have and how they're going to measure its effectiveness, and they look at how it's actually working. Another thing that we gain that we saw for employers in this book is better staffing coverage to meet peak demands, such as covering peak seasons and demands for employee travel, et cetera. You'll hear about those examples, I'm sure, from particularly from the companies here. So When Work Works has been very successful for us. It is a project where we are translating research to action. We're taking our research on what is an effective workplace. We're giving an award for employers who are effective and flexible. And we've created this guide. We're also, each company that applies gets a benchmarking report so that it can compare itself against, both national standards, because the companies that are winners, are in the top 80% based on national norms. And they can see how they're doing on all of these areas against both the winners of the award and against national standards. We also found that there's a community business case, and why we're working in communities is because communities have reasons to get involved in creating more effective and flexible workplaces. To promote regional economic development, Dallas and Lexington, Kentucky are two examples of that, where there's a real interest in improving the economic development in their region. To recruit and retain a multi-generational workforce, that's true, particularly of keeping younger professionals there. A lot of communities are college places, and they found that they educated people and then they moved on. So Birmingham and Boise and Charleston and Milwaukee. Or to address worker shortages, for example, in Chicago or Rochester, Minnesota. To recruit and retain women in leadership positions, that was the goal for Providence for getting involved in When Work Works. To respond to a changing economy and changing economic conditions, Aurora, Colorado, which has moved from a bedroom community to a boardroom community. Or we have a number of communities in the Rust Belt, like Detroit, where they're trying to move into new technology and they need to create effective workplaces. Or to go green, to reduce traffic congestion such as Seattle, Houston, and Long Island. So that's the initiative that we have in When Work Works. It helps raise awareness to create change and to engage people in action in creative workplaces that work for the employer and work for the employee. Thank you very much.
I think we could I love the data, because the data is really what a lot of us came for, is to hear about, you know, what we know, experience knows. This is a compelling business case, but it really helps to have the research, and I love that we're turning it into action. So thank you again, Ellen. So I'm Sally Thornton, and I started FlexPerience with my co-founders who are here, Michelle and Lara, to really connect great companies who want to have this kind of flexible workforce when they want it. And what we see, which is that employee-centric, we call it talent, but there are independent consultants, focus on them, allowing them to contribute their full skills to the workplace on terms that work for their life. So that's what FlexPerience does, and part of our initiative is to educate both sides of the equation. So we like to have events for our talent around how do you blend work and family in new ways, and then we like to have events for our clients and companies to think about how to have this flexibility in-house, and then it creates a better environment for our talent when they go in. So we really believe in this win-win that Ellen was talking about, and we want to make sure today that you walk away with great ideas, because as you heard from across the nation with Ellen, and then you're going to hear today in the Bay Area, there are such great pockets of innovation, progressive thought around flexibility. But how do you bring this together and create an action plan for yourself? So we want to make sure that today you walk away with actionable ideas and inspirational thoughts and connections with other people in maybe relevant fields that you can, you know, come away with best practices that translate into a better work environment for you and for your company. So with that, I want to hear, we want to keep this interactive, so, you know, feel free to raise your hand. We're going to have a Q&A at the end, but you have cards on your table. If you want to submit cards, we'll have a break where you can give us the Q&A. But we want to hear from our panelists. What are they doing? Each of them is going to tell us their own overview, and then we're going to have some questions that you guys submitted to us, but please keep this an open dialogue, because that makes it a lot more fun, better energy. So let's start with the overview with our gold sponsor, Joshua from Nixon. Can you tell us a little bit about what Nixon Peabody is up to, big picture?
Yeah, sure. Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me?
Move a little closer.
No.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, I'm Josh Henderson, and I'm an attorney at Nixon Peabody. Nixon Peabody's a large law firm of about 700 lawyers nationwide. And we've opened up offices recently in London and Shanghai as well. We've been named as in Fortune magazine's top 100 places to work for the last 3 years. And we really see workplace flexibility as a way of maintaining that position, as a way of maintaining the law firm as a great place to work. The firm has had ad hoc workplace flexibility policies for some time. And it was only in February of this year that we've issued a formal written policy. And the reason we did that is, you know, the ad hoc policy worked for some and didn't work for others. There was no firm-wide monitoring, no checks and balances to make sure that like cases were being treated alike, that people were being treated fairly. And so we've entered this brave new world of flexible policies, and then that would include, you know, flexible time, flexible space, and reduced work arrangements. You know, we're a law firm, we're a partnership. I think there's some things remain to be seen in terms of the effect of this and how people will actually take advantage of it. Some have already, and we want to encourage others to do so as well. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm here to impart any wisdom to the extent I can, but also to learn from others. Thank you.
How long have you had the flexibility policy in place? When did it move from ad hoc to structural?
February of this year, we actually issued the policy.
Fabulous.
And, you know, I mean, that was the result of a lot of legwork on behalf of many members of the firm, both attorneys and staff in terms of formulating a policy that worked, because we wanted a policy with teeth, not just a paper tiger.
Fantastic. Yeah. So Marilyn from Cisco, we're thrilled to have, because we have a lot of professional services, which absolutely makes sense because of the billable hours challenge. But from a Cisco perspective, I think Cisco is still the largest Bay Area employer. Is that true?
I don't know.
You don't know. Well, a couple of years ago it was true. I'm only wondering if Google, I don't think they've overtaken. But so tell us a little bit about what Cisco's done, how long it's been in place. Give us that overview.
Okay. I'll move closer and get taller. Oh, there we go. Oh, even better. We're really in the journey toward formalizing most of our flexibility policies. Cisco has about 65,000 employees worldwide, and we recently did a survey to understand a little bit about how people work and where they work, and over 40% of our managers manage people in another location. So we're set up in remote management to be able to have people work flexibly. The other thing that I think sets Cisco up for success in this area is our technology. So every employee has accessibility in terms of VPN at home, fast service globally if it's available in the country. And they also have PDAs. Everybody gets a video camera if you want to do video chats with people. So everyone has a laptop. So we're set up to really take advantage of a lot of the tools that we have. We also, in fact, use telepresence for one of our executives, admin, and you know how executives are very attached to their admin. So the admin was moving to another part of the country and said, I'd still love to work and support you, but I don't know how I can do that. And so the company set up a telepresence unit. Our telepresence is video conferencing that's lifelike to the degree of seeing the sweat on the can of soda. So they set up a telepresence unit in this woman's home, and her boss has a telepresence unit, so it looks like she's sitting right outside his door, but in fact she's several states away and works from home. So it works out quite well. In her case, she can't work in the pajamas, one of the things people always talk about in terms of telecommuting. But we formalize our process, our mobility workers or enterprise class teleworkers, and those are folks who work completely from their home unit like this admin at least, I think, 2 years ago. And what we're looking at this year is formalizing a lot of the other programs that we have, such as part-time, et cetera. And I can go into those in another question.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great.
So, that one.
Excellent. Tim, E&Y. I'm sorry we don't have the poster, so I'm just going to keep reminding you who they are.
Hi, good morning, everybody. My name is Tim Stevens. I'm a partner here in San Francisco with Ernst & Young. Ernst & Young has about 130,000 people worldwide in 140 countries. We are a audit and tax and transaction and advisory professional services business, so lots of people, intensive delivery of services to our clients. Obviously, people are very important to Ernst & Young, and I'll talk a little bit more about what Ellen referred to as people first, just really briefly here. But my role is as the flexibility champion for the Pacific Northwest. That's 8 offices here in Northern California, Oregon, Washington, Northern Nevada, and Utah, about 2,200 people. And my job is to help transform our culture of around embracing flexibility and beyond just some of the programs that we've had in place for a number of years around flexible work arrangements to really a day-to-day type of flexibility view. How do all of us unlock some of those flexibility riddles? We have this people-first culture that the firm adopted in the early 2000s when it became very clear that we need to make sure that we're cultivating and developing our workforce, a very apprentice-driven organization, and it became very clear to us that the cost of recruiting the talent that we need to serve our clients and probably most of all retaining that talent was becoming increasingly you know, our primary business issue. And I think we'll hear, especially for those on the panel here that have that people-intensive culture or requirement, that you know, flexibility really isn't a choice anymore. It's really the price of admission, you know, really so that we can achieve this inclusive culture and a diverse workforce. And this price of admission, you know, is really required to attract and retain those people that we need to run our business into the future.
Fantastic. Thank you. Molly from Deloitte.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Molly Anderson. I'm a director in Deloitte's talent organization, which many other companies would call human resources. I grew up in Deloitte's consulting business, and I've been in a role for about 18 months leading the implementation of what we call mass career customization. Mass career customization for us is a new model for how careers are built and talent is developed, and I'll share with you a little bit kind of the 50,000-foot view of what that means. My role last year was to implement that new model for 7,500 folks based in the U.S. across all of our businesses in a cross-section of the organization. And this year, the challenge for our team is to take it out to another 33,000 individuals within Deloitte. And to make sense of mass career customization, because it's quite new, it helps to understand a little bit of the journey that we took. And 4 or 5 years ago, we were taking a really hard look at the issue of flexibility, which is a very complicated, many-pronged issue, as most of you in this room know. And one of the things we did was pretty straightforward. We just took an inventory of the programs we had, and we found 69 of them. And then we asked people at different levels of our organization, can you name five? Work in teams, collaborate, name five. And, of course, in a 40,000-person organization, which is what our U.S. business is, it becomes very difficult for 69 programs to have mindshare. And when they're not known, it's very difficult for them to generate value for the individuals in the organization or for the organization itself. And as we looked at those 69 programs, we also really began to challenge ourselves and say, you know, are these addressing the root cause? Are we investing this money wisely? Are we getting the gains that we want to be seeing out of these? And as we really started to dig into all the trends that were just shared with you by Ellen a few moments ago and understand what they had meant to our organization, one of the things that really struck us is we think that there actually has been amongst our people a shift in the paradigm for thinking about how careers grow and how talent develops. And that is, for a very long time, the mental model or image that organizations have held has been the model of the corporate ladder. Right? A linear straight-up climb. You need to contribute the same amount at every point in time. The gold standard of personal success is how quickly you rise, right, and is determined by how high you are. And as we talked to our talent, as we looked at what was happening within our own organization across others, really people today who have been impacted by all those trends that were described are thinking about their careers and how they develop their talents very differently. They're redefining what success means. And we came up with a name to give that a label. What is this new mental model that folks are starting to think about careers through? Called it the corporate lattice. Right? And so I happen to be married to a mathematician. You know, a lattice is a mathematical construct. It can scale infinitely. You can move in any direction. A lot of people think of a garden lattice, a platform for organic growth. A Gen Yer on my team, I did not create this analogy, said, think of it like a climbing wall. That is, you know, you're oriented towards the top, right? Your eye is always on your end goal. But sometimes your best path is to take a few steps sideways. Sometimes your best path might even be to take a little step downwards. And other times, you want to power straight up and power hard. And so it's a much more expansive notion then of how careers develop. It recognizes that they ebb and flow, that the intensity with which we can contribute at any point in time varies. So we say, okay, well, pat ourselves on the back. Good insight. We sort of have understood more of the root cause here, but how are we going to operationalize that in a U.S. business of 40,000 people? And that led us to the invention of mass career customization, and that the inspiration, it can be a mouthful, mass career customization, or MCC as we call it for short, came out of mass product customization. which is very much the world that our Gen X and Gen Y folks have grown up in, right? You can order your coffee in many different varieties and forms. You can get your music in the way you want it. You can download your ringtones. You can even go to the U.S. Postal Service and get your custom postage stamps. So why couldn't you have a custom career? And with that as our inspiration, we developed a framework that is a structure for offering a defined set of choices, not an infinite set, but a defined set of choices across what we call four core dimensions of a career. Your pace, how quickly you want to grow, your workload, are you full or part-time, what we call location schedule, which is when and where work gets done, and your role, where are you on that spectrum from individual contributor to leader. And I see a lot of you writing furiously. There are there were some free MCC books. We've written a book with Harvard Business School on this topic that were out there. But for those of you who didn't get those, there is also a little mini book, and it has the MCC framework in it and those four dimensions that I just described. And this structure, then, is a structure for employees and managers to have a dialogue about career and life all the time, continually. Everyone participates in mass career customization all the time. It's important to talk about not just the present but the future. Retention in our organization, we get a lot of folks, which I'm sure all of you do too, who say, I love the job I'm doing. I'm learning. I'm growing. I love the people I work with. I'm leaving. Because 3 years down the road, I'm not sure I'll be able to make it work. And so that continual dialogue, both about present circumstances and future options, really became key for us. And having a consistent, structured way to do it across a big organization was also very important to us. And so that's the journey that we've been on and that I can share more about later.
Fantastic. Excellent, Sharon. Yes, Sharon.
I'm Sharon Kloon from Accenture. Is this on?
Yep. Try a little closer.
Okay.
Like, how about that?
Love it. Love it.
Now you can hear me. Thank you. And I want to say, Ellen, you gave me a great introduction with a lot of suspense. So I'll tell you about future leave, but first let me take a second and tell you about Accenture. Accenture is a high-tech consulting, management consulting company. Globally, we have about 30,000 employees here in the U.S., and I manage the 30,000 employees from a work-life slash wellness initiative. One of the things that we have really looked at is, and I think the term time famine is absolutely perfect, because being a consulting firm, we have 30,000 people basically with laptops, and they go to client sites and they work on projects, and some of them do work in their home. We had employees who did have access to maybe daily flexibility, but what I want to tell you about is future leave, and future leave is career flexibility. What we heard from our employees is that with all of the challenges that they had with their work-life commitments and their personal responsibilities, they really had things coming up in their life from kind of a different value system from Gen Y to X to boomers that they were looking at and saying, you know what? This is not working for me. I can't do what I need to do and what's important to me when I have just my vacation. This isn't giving me enough time. And you look at individuals who are handling elder care issues, young children. You look at Generation Y who have just different values that, you know, that group wants to go contribute in a third world country. So what we did was come up with future leave because people were saying, I need more time and I need a longer chunk of time, but I really want to keep my career. And I can't figure out how to do this. So let me tell you what future leave is. It's basically a self-funded sabbatical. What it enables our employees to do is pick a time in the future that they want to be away. It's up to 3 months. Generally, people pick time maybe a year from now when they know there's really something big coming in their life that they need time. And again, it's not just 3 months. You can take 7 weeks. You can take 8 weeks. You can take less. You can take, but the max is 12 weeks. And what this enables people to do is kind of start planning this self-funded sabbatical, and this is how it works. From the time they're accepted on this future leave path or program, they're allowed to contribute a percentage of their pay every paycheck into a kind of an account. Now, it used to be that the company held that money. Now we have it going directly to the employee in a savings account. But basically, they can take 5, 10, or 15% of their paycheck and contribute it to account. So over 9 months, 12 months, 13 months, whatever they're looking at to kind of save for that event. At the end of the time when they start future leave, they have a chunk of money that they can pay for and basically kind of subsidize themselves. What Accenture does, on the other hand, is they continue the employee benefits. Generally, if you go on a personal leave, you know, you have where all of a sudden the employee is paying a lot more money. So what Accenture said is we're going to pick up all of your medical for this time period. At the end of the time period, then you come back from your future leave in the same role you were in and kind of start from there. The leaders have really embraced this because, one, they have time to plan. It is not just someone coming to them and saying, okay, you know what? My father had a stroke. I need to be gone in 2 weeks for, you know, 3 months, 2 months. I have to be gone. I have to have the time away. It gives the leaders time to plan. So how are you going to backfill that position, that role, that responsibility in the coming year or that three-month period? And who can I bring in for kind of career development? The employees love it because it truly is cross-generational. It's cross-level. It is cross, you name it, cross-values, and it appeals to everyone. The other thing about future leave that we found is it has really gotten us such a high positive impact in engagement, retention, and recruitment tools with an extremely low ROI. Our Accenture's investment is in the medical portion only. And what we're also hearing from employees across the country is, you know what, it really doesn't matter if I need future leave right now. I know it's there. And that is a huge home run for me in trying to plan my career. And I can really see myself at Accenture longer because of that. We also make sure that employees do not have to tell us why. Why do they want the time? You know, I don't want anyone in a subjective position trying to figure out, well, is taking care of a child more important than an elderly parent? And it's, again, it's used equally, I think, by men and women for different reasons. The bottom line is that I think this is also kind of a customizable plan that will work with probably any organization out there with very little uptake. So that's what I wanted to share with you. And with that, I will end my comments.
Great. Sharon, how long have you had this in place?
We've actually had it in place. We're going into our fourth year. We started it with a very, very small pilot about 4 years ago. Then we piloted it across, and we got extremely positive feedback. We also started measuring the number of people who said, if I had not access to future leave, I would have quit. And to be able to kind of extrapolate those numbers into, you know, figuring out the replacement cost of people was just absolutely enormous. We took it to a U.S. pilot 2 years ago, and it's now been U.S.-wide for nearly 2 years. The other point that I would say is that especially in an economy that we're looking at right now where companies do not have a bucket of money to give to your, you know, raises and incentives, think of time as a commodity. This time famine is the new trade. So I'll stop there.
So one more question, because I saw some pregnant ladies in the audience. How does it relate with pregnancy leave? Does it add on to the Family Medical Leave Act, or is it?
You can actually do that. What we're finding is that actually happens really rarely because many times, because you sort of do have to plan it in the future, you can, but generally women are taking some of their vacation for that. Some do access it. What we're generally seeing it for are, let me give you a couple examples. Either, you know, really someone has an elderly parent that needs to be moved. Maybe their home needs to be sold. We've also seen it where a family member is sick. There was a gentleman who came up to us and said, my father has had a stroke and the family business is going under. I'm the only one that can keep us out of bankruptcy from a family position. He stepped in. And Generation Y, who said, okay, I've been here a year. This isn't working for me. You know what I want to do is I want to go teach 3 weeks in a third world country. So being able to give flexibility at all levels has worked in addition to the maternity.
Yeah, well, and I think the gender neutral theme of all of the companies is a really strong underpinning because it does tend to be something that a lot of women talk about for obvious reasons, but the fact that it's a business solution is definitely something we want to pull on. I was just curious. So if someone has a pregnancy leave, they can add this on to it.
Absolutely.
This is not in lieu of the normal.
No.
Yeah, so it's additional.
Completely separate animal.
Fantastic. Okay. Please.
Two comments. As long as we're on service firms and the wonderful things that they've done, I'd like to tell you about what KPMG has done in terms of having
putting out a notice over the internet if someone has an emergency. This is not something that you plan for, and other people donating their leaves. So it's an anonymous request that goes out on the internet, and then other people donate their unused leave, and they've had their requests filled usually within minutes. It's just another wonderful way that people can think about it. And if you think about flex careers, which a lot of us are talking about, think about also phased retirement and another health system, Bon Secours in Richmond, and is, again, one of our winners. They have created a culture of aging where they are working to help people stay because they need the experienced people in the healthcare field. So they give benefits if you work, I think, over 15 hours, and they employees can use their child care center. They help people plan for retirement. So that there's a lot of ingenuity going on with redefining careers. I think that mass career customization is a brilliant notion because it puts it all into one conceptual framework and takes a life cycle perspective, but it really does respond to the changing demographics.
And it's nice to have all of these tools. You know, all of these companies have done it, approached it different ways. Now I want to take a bit of a deeper dive because you've sort of had that overview framework. So let's take the deep dive. The one question that I always hear from our clients is, give me the data, economic reality. Why do I do this? It might be because it's green. It might be a wellness strategy. It's an admission ticket, right, for retention. But any hard facts on the economics that you guys can share? And let's start back with Josh.
In terms of the hard economics, I'm not sure I have the data at my fingertips. I just know conceptually and from my experience anecdotally and being a mentor to some folks who have wanted to take advantage of workplace flexibility is it is a critical component in terms of retention. And a number of the panelists have touched upon it, but and it's also a way just that the cost, both the financial cost and the personal investment in training and retaining associates at a law firm, once you impart that on some of the those with the old school attitudes, I mean that's a way to win them over.
Yes.
But I'd be interested in some of the hard data from some of the other folks as well.
Anyone? Do you want to jump in?
Well, the one thing I think we can measure is that the average person in the Bay Area spends about an hour commuting to work and home, and that's if they don't hit one of the major highways, the misnomer freeways. So we know that people, and this is, I think each program has its own metrics associated with it, but I think that for people who are telecommuting or working from home, that's 2 hours of productive time that they're donating to their job, either sitting in their car in traffic or actually working. So, and we just, if you can calculate the return on investment just for that alone, I think it more than covers a lot of the expense.
Fantastic.
The average person actually in the U.S. spends 51 minutes commuting each, both round trip.
Yeah, Bay Area is probably a little higher.
And I would say that our data showed a couple of points. Ellen talked about it with the 83%. When you have 83% of 30,000 people saying, okay, I either get the flexibility I need or I am so out the door, that's a real wake-up call. The other piece is that we asked people who needed flexibility if they could ask for it comfortably. 40% said they could not. Okay, start putting those numbers together. We also looked at 300 people who the previous year had taken time away unpaid, were able to come back to work, and the question was, if you did not have access to this time away, would you have quit? And 79% of those people basically said, if I did not have more of the career flexibility, I would have had to leave. You start doing the numbers on that, and that's where you get, I think, the ROI.
Excellent. A question? Yeah, and for the podcast, I'll just sort of say it again. So for the question for Cisco is, productivity is measured in the full-time perspective. You can think about regaining the commute and that kind of thing. How do you think about productivity on a part-time perspective and in a flexible mindset?
Well, I think that the challenge for those of us who are in high tech or in any of those types of organizations is that we expect people to work more than 40 hours when they're full-time employees. So I actually think there's a good argument for using the same amount of salary dollars and splitting it into two. So now this may be a convoluted rationale on my part, but if you think about one employee 40 hours a week, but they're really working, the average person's maybe about 55 or 56 hours a week. Let's just make it 60 to round up because we know that can happen, and make it really a challenge for someone to work 60 hours week in and week out. If you divide that job into two, and that's 20 hours and 20 hours, and each one of those people puts in an extra 10 hours, let's just say a little bit here and there. So the few days that they work a little bit longer. You've got 80 hours, but you don't have burnout. Now, I'm not sure that's the argument we want to propose for people for offering part-time work, but we know that the reality of our industry is that people do work extra amount of time. They used to joke and say that the reason we gave out popcorn and drinks is to keep people all night, you know. And some people actually do, you know, take a little nap in their cube once in a while because they're there too many hours. But I think that particularly in our industry, we need to give people something to balance the challenge of the workload. And so we know that we're not going to lighten the workload just flat out. We're always trying to do more with less. So how do you balance that? You need to balance that by giving people the opportunity to go pick up their dry cleaning in the middle of the day because they're working from home, or work a little bit in the morning, take time off during the day, and work a little bit at night when they put the kids to bed, or take off for 2 years for child raising and come back without having to reapply. I think if we don't offer those kinds of things to people, we can't maintain them. And we don't have high attrition rates at Cisco, so I never use that as an argument. But I think that we will if we don't put things in place to help balance that. So I'm not sure if that was a great answer to your question, but that's kind of the way I look at it. Two 20s work 10 extra hours, you still have 80 hours. And no one's work, I mean,
60. 40,
60 hours. Mm-hmm. And no one is working more, you know, I mean, if you work 60 hours a week, week in and week out, you're going to have to quit. Or if you're lucky enough to get the 3 months off, you're going to have to do something like that.
Yeah, productivity. Ellen, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I do. I think that just the way our image of a career is of a ladder, our image of work is running a marathon without ever stopping. But if you think about professional athletes, the way that they train is to have time for rest and recovery in between the times that they're really going for their peak performance. And we need to reinvent the notion of how we work, that everybody needs time. If you read the book, The Corporate Athlete, for example, it talks about working in 90-minute spurts as being optimal and then a little time for rest and recovery and then working again. The point that I wanted to make, though, was a slightly different point, which is we need to reinvent the notion away from just looking at people, the jacket on the back of the chair as a measure of productivity, to results and the companies that have been the most successful, whatever is going on next door. They're working too hard. They're burning out.
Something.
Something is going on next door.
Must be sales team meeting.
Anyway.
Sales people are crazy.
That the companies that have been successful, and I think we have to think of results versus just simply time. You can be there. You can put in a lot of time and not really accomplish very much. So the companies that have moved toward more flexibility are putting metrics on it. Also, the companies that have moved toward more flexibility are not assuming that all of that time you spent is a good use of your time. And IBM has created an initiative that I particularly like. It's called POWR, which looks at the notion of bringing a team together and asking through a series of guided questions similar to the kind of guided questions you have in mass career customization, what are you doing that's a waste of time? What are you doing that makes you go home and say, oh, my God, you won't believe what happened to me today? And and going around the group and seeing if those things really are a waste of time and whether they can be improved. Can you take the time that you have and use it more efficiently and more effectively? So moving away from the definition of time, work as a marathon, looking at results versus simply time spent, and looking at how that time is spent and trying to create more effective and efficient uses of the time. In with IBM and Texas Instruments has done something similar. They create metrics to look at how they're going to know whether this new plan of using their time more effectively through power is yielding results. So I think tying metrics into any experimental change you make, Sharon's notion of piloting, your notion of piloting, Olivier's notion of moving from informal flexibility to more policies, all of these came out of pilots. You don't just launch into something full scale. You try it out, you get the kinks out of the system, and then you develop it further.
So since we you have data?
I was just going to say, building on what Ellen has said, you know, underneath it all, when I get asked that question in all kinds of forms and flavors, there is an implicit notion that there's an alternative, right, that we don't have to offer part-time or find a way to make it work, for example, in this case. And so one of the successes that we've had in engaging our leadership is to use a lot of the trend data that Ellen opened with to paint the picture of the world in which it is not an option to not be able to offer options. And once that's understood, the nature of the debate changes from should we offer options to which options should we offer and how can we do it effectively. And those are two very different questions to be posing. And so our business case starts with looking at things like the talent shortage in the U.S., the 6 million person gap by 2012, like the importance of women in the workforce. 60% of undergraduate and graduate degrees go to women, and yet there's quite a bit of quantified research on how their careers are not linear, like the kinds of things Ellen talked about how the changes in family structure have not impacted just women but men. And men have many needs and changing preferences around how career and life come together. For many organizations, including our own, who have a lot of boomers, who have a lot of important knowledge and skill and will be retiring in waves, 70% of folks who are retired say they would have extended their working career if they had had more flexibility options. If you look at Gen X, Gen Y, boomers, and even veterans, so across all of the research on generations, flexibility is an issue for each of those generations. And so for us, building the breadth of business case, that it's not a single workforce trend. It's not a single group of employees across gender, across generation. There's this set of forces that are coming together that you cannot ignore. And most leaders, when presented with that case in a compelling way that's customized to your organization, so what are those trends doing? Look at your retention rates, your employee surveys, your exit interviews, and so forth, which all of you are quite familiar with, will then agree that in the face of that picture, continuing to not offer options is not viable. And so then when you shift the debate into, okay, so what should we do? Now you're on a different playing ground. Now, of course, we do put a lot of metrics in. I would encourage anyone to do that. Some of the key ones have been talked about on the cost side. Retention's always at the top of the list. Don't forget to look at the revenue side. Particularly, you know, most of us as managers and leaders grew up in the world where there were more people than jobs. And so we wrote our business plans and our strategic plans assuming that we could get as many people as we had positions, right? That assumption's now out the door. So even at the very strategic level, looking and forecasting out, look a decade in the future. What is your ability to acquire talent likely to do to your growth stream? That's another very productive place to explore. And then you can get down into the more specific metrics around your programs. But I really encourage you. I mean, I think internally there's not a presentation I start. And I tell all our other change agents, you know, just never start without going through the business case, without letting people understand the changed nature of the world in which we are now operating, because that really creates a whole different engagement point.
The other suggestion that I would make is when you look at turnover data of your A players, and then your B, and then your C. And what you will likely find is that your A players have a lot of choice in how they work and where they work, and your C players may stay. So when you look at turnover, you know, you also want to look at performance management. We've got a lot of good questions.
I just want to add something.
Yeah, go ahead.
We've been putting together business case around this, and I think there's incredible data that supports it. But I think we're starting to shift and look at this in a new way to say this is part of the manager's toolkit.
Yep.
This is an advantage for managers who have to get the work done. And I think if we approach it as, we've got to convince managers because they're used to managing by FaceTime mm-hmm. or time in itself, I think we're not even going the full distance. So I really see this as positioned as this is a phenomenal tool for managers to have. Because it's just as important to their being able to manage their business as getting resources.
Fantastic. And any strategies that you guys use to overcome these obstacles that they're feeling around culture, around, you know, how managers have adopted or embraced this? Anything you guys have seen in the learnings? I do, but I want to get to make sure because I know this is actually was asked before
just
the event.
A couple things that we've been doing. Mm-hmm. At Ernst & Young, specifically here in the Pac Northwest, there's really four things that we're trying to do to help our managers. And our belief is that all of this starts with a really good, honest communication process. To get the flexibility you need, you have to be able to ask for it. And to get that flexibility you need to be able to define it. So what we've been doing is on a couple levels, seeding our organization with what we call the Flexibility Champions Network. And these are people that are change agents, as we've talked about, that understand the business case, that can articulate the business case, that have been through a training session called Fierce Conversations, which is based on Susan Scott's book. If you haven't picked up Fierce is a great tool for enabling our people to have those conversations, a difficult conversation for many to ask for what they want. So our Champions Network is equipped to be able to start those conversations, assist their colleagues, their subordinates, their superiors with having these conversations in their setting of their teams. Similarly, from a team perspective, there was some discussion earlier about team dynamics, and what we also have is a concept called team acceleration, where our teams are in workshops to understand how they work, what they do to accomplish work, what they do to be barriers to their own success. And this team acceleration concept has been terrific. It's really helped a lot of these teams unlock their full potential, and as a revenue benefit, we get better client satisfaction results from these teams. So those two pieces, and then some of my colleagues are here in the room also around the flexible work arrangement process as well. That's a challenge in a professional services organization where there's a lot of pressure to be in front of your teams or in front of your clients and on the partner track. We have a number of our partners who have made the flexible work arrangement where you're reducing the number of hours you're working, as we talked about, but supporting those that maybe haven't been as successful in the past. Helping and coaching them to have the conversations and to set the boundaries that are necessary for success. So this toolkit that you talked about, these are some of the things that we're doing to throw into our manager's toolkit.
Fantastic. I know there's burning questions. Let's start in the back.
Can you talk about how you...
exempt and non-exempt employees?
Yeah, probably non-exempt.
Right. Okay. Any strategies for the hourly employees? Is it any different?
Yeah, I mean, for us, that our non-client-serving professionals are also part of our Flexibility Champions Network. They participate in the same types of programs. We all have clients. We serve each other. We serve our fee-paying clients as well, and we adopt that mentality that we're all part of this together. So it's one set of programs, at least for us.
Okay. Any other?
I just want to say I think there's
the attorney must talk about that.
No, I'll engage in shameless self-promotion a little bit later. But I think there's no question that flexible workplace policies put additional burdens on coworkers, especially when we're talking about non-exempt. And that's a difficult conversation to have as a manager. I mean, you have to convince them that this is you know, this is the 21st century, and this is the way it has to be. This is not an
option. The future of work.
Yeah.
The title, yes.
and that, you know, and hopefully it will work out in the end, and they'll get different opportunities. But it's a difficult conversation, for sure.
Any learnings there? That was a specific question that came up. How do you avoid the divisions? How do you avoid the stigmatizing of people who do choose these flexible work arrangements? I know MCC, the whole strategy tries to avoid the stigmatization. I can't get that word. But for the rest of you who people are opting into a program, how do you create that camaraderie amongst the team when people are doing different things for flexibility?
Could I just say something about the low-wage workforce?
Sure.
Before? Two observations. The first is that when we look at the return on investment for the lower wage and income workforce versus the higher wage, higher income workforce, and we look at wage and income together, not just lower wage, but lower wage employees who live in lower income households, we find that the return is much greater. So that assumption, I think it's very important to know that you're going to get even more by investing in this part of the workforce. The second observation is that Citigroup developed a process to work on this based on the law that's in both the UK and in Australia, the Just Ask law, where the notion is that anyone at the company has the right to ask for flexibility. They don't have the 69 programs. It's just, you know, you can ask for whatever you think you need. You have to look at it in terms of how it will work out for your coworkers. You have to take the perspective of your team, its results, what needs to be done, and then you go make your own business case. The manager is required not to say no immediately. And then they are, if there's an impasse, there's an ombuds person within different parts of Citigroup who will help you resolve the issue. This was particularly aimed at their, you know, their call centers, their check processors, their people who couldn't ask. And we find in our national studies that even though there's a lot of discussion between about resentment, this leads mm-hmm. into your
sure.
next question, but there's a lot of discussion about resentment, people with kids versus people without, men versus women. The only statistical resentment we find in the National Study of the Changing Workforce is between people who are lower income versus people who are higher income, and that's because lower income people have so much less access to flexibility in almost every way we look at it. When they do have it, the benefit is even greater.
And I would probably add on to that what we have done from a flexibility standpoint is with our non-exempt, we have kind of crafted a conversational platform where a couple of things happen during every annual review. We now have a personal engagement list, not only for our exempt employees, but our non-exempt employees, which helps start that discussion about what really is important to you and to other people's point. Not everyone is really asking for flexibility. However, when that does come up and you might have someone who is an administrative assistant who has to be there to open the door, you know, we've actually put it back on the team to say, okay, now someone has asked for flexibility, and we really don't want to say no, so can you guys kind of go away and figure out how to make it work? And you would not believe the creativity that comes from the people who are the closest to the work to be able to come up with these ideas that no leader would have thought about, but they're saying, okay, well, I'll take this day, and then this person will take this day, and then it'll work out. So I would certainly not underestimate being very, you know, turning the problem, the challenge back. Brilliant ideas are out there.
I like that, turning it back to the work team so they can solve amongst themselves. That's how I manage my children. Okay, in the middle, we actually have some men here. I love it. Okay, let's talk about the attitude towards part-time work.
I think there's a huge body of people who would love to work but have limited amount of time. When you look at the cost of childcare nowadays, there are so many two-income households that have to make a decision. Is it worth the second person working given how much you're going to have to pay for childcare? So I mean, we have people who work the amount of hours that they can work. Our part-time is 20 hours to get benefits, but we're even looking at that as maybe we need to push that envelope for the people who can work 15 hours. We're not so sure yet what the incremental cost is. But a person who works part-time, if you manage to the work, then none of it is a problem.
Yeah.
So if you're managing a person to the objectives that you give them or the tasks or whatever it is, depending on their level, whether it's an hourly worker, administrative assistant, or it's a VP, if you give them a reasonable amount of work for the amount of time that they have, then it doesn't matter how many hours they put in, and it shouldn't. And if you're the leader and you have 50 tasks or 50 objectives, MBOs or whatever you call them, you figure out how you're going to get those 50 things done with the amount of people that you have. And one of those people is 20 hours, and one of those people is 40 hours, and one of those people is 15 hours. It doesn't matter. It's still you're managing to the work. And I think that's the underpinning. So if your administrative assistant wants to work from home, are they going to get the work done? If they're not greeting people and meeting people except over the phone, why not?
And I'll add on to that because I got some pre-questions on job sharing. Job sharing, the burning questions from attendees were, is it considered to be a business strategy or an accommodation? And you know, how prevalent or what's your perspective on job sharing as a critical business issue for your individual businesses? Does anybody have personal experience?
Can I just start with some statistics about job sharing? It has not grown it's been talked about a lot, but actually not grown. In our latest study, we have 29% of employers that at least allow some people to job share, a nationally representative sample of 50 or more, but only 8% make it more widely available. And
maybe attitudes are stopping that. What are the attitudes?
I think that where the notion of job share that is that two people actually share one job, so you share the benefits line, you share the responsibility. I think where people have moved is toward more reduced time with defined responsibilities rather than asking two people to communicate with each other, although that hasn't grown either by our definition. But our definition is a pretty strict definition, however, because it has to work for the employee and the employer. But I think that the growth has been in taking the chunk approach that you're talking about. What are the tasks? How much time do people have? Mm-hmm. Rather than saying, here's one job, you two have to communicate really well and make sure you're transferring to each other, which requires a whole other level of supervision. Not that it isn't great where it works.
I think both are options, but I think I would agree that you need to make both available to employees. They can job share, but they have to then find that partner that wants to do it with them. And what if one of them leaves, then they have to find another partner. Or you can just look at reduced work hours. I think it's appropriate to offer both, but if you offer the job share, you have to have a mechanism for people to find the other person. So it makes it easier. I mean, it's a little less difficult to just say, I want to work X number of hours.
HP has done a really good job. They have 7 executive job shares, and they have a mentoring team. So the job shares that have been there for quite some time then mentor the job shares that have just begun. And they're at the VP level. And their perspective is, you know, there no job that they know of at a VP level is going to be reduced hours. So how can they have significant responsibility on a reduced hours? And the only way is to create a position that has results associated with it. And the two talk amongst themselves about how to get it done.
And I guess I would say that we have job share offered to everyone. We have part-time offered to everyone. The challenge with job share, to your point, is if it falls apart, the wheels come off, and then it's been very challenging for the next connection to have that very unique set of skills. So historically, it may start out as a job share, but it turns into part-time. Because from a leadership perspective, I think people, our leaders, are feeling more comfortable in defining objectives and really understanding who owns what. from a performance, from a review standpoint, et cetera, et cetera.
The other successful example that I'll share is a CFO job share that I know about in Southern California, where when you go back to the business strategy was they want a CFO who is savvy with Wall Street and who knows Sarbanes-Oxley and SOX and all the compliance issues that are so important today. And what they found was, in general, CFOs tend to not have both skill sets because they're really different kinds of personalities. So what they found was an executive job share. Two baby boomers who had been CFOs before had wildly different strengths, but together, combined, were much more productive for the business and then at the same unit cost. So there are different ways. I always love bringing it back to the results. So what are you trying to achieve in the role? If two people are bringing complementary skills that wouldn't necessarily reside in one person, then you really do walk away better than a reduced work environment. Okay, Catherine. My goodness, so many questions. So for the podcast, I just have to repeat the question. On ramping, do you have programs where you bring people who've been taken time off? And how do you define it? Over a year is off-ramp? Any comments on ramping?
Lehman Brothers defines it as 3 to 5 years out. They have an encore program where they specifically recruit people who have experience in the financial sector and have been out 3 to 5 years, and they do include flexibility, although, you know, it depends on the boss about whether you're going to ask for it or not. But Joe Gregory, who's the person who's in charge of it at Lehman Brothers, really sees this as a chance to coach one-on-one with the senior people who need this particular talent, to help them look at people who don't want to work full time. Although he's had to do a one-on-one coaching with the people who are in the Encore program.
Well, and you know, when Wall Street adopts an on-ramping program, that there's a good ROI, you know, because Wall Street's not doing it out of the kindness of their hearts.
We have an alumni.
I can tell you, our recruiters are anxious for us to formalize our policies so that they can start recruiting part-time people. But the other thing that we're doing is we're looking to implement an off-ramp policy that you can leave for 2 years and come back. So you don't really leave. You still maintain your laptop and connectivity. You probably want to stay connected, and we're looking at what kind of structure we need to keep people up to date without them working. But you can leave for 2 years and come back without interrupting your career, without having to look as an external to find a job. So that is one way we're approaching the off-ramp, on-ramp situation. But, I mean, I think recruiters are having a harder and harder time. So they're looking to...
For creative ways.
For businesses to say, open the door to some other things because I can get you more people.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is about money here, so let me share another kind of dimension. We have something called an alumni association, so when you do leave, you're gone, but you're not really that far away, and there's a connectivity going on the whole time, so it helps when, you know, if people kind of know what your skills are and you're good at them and you've stayed connected, and maybe it's even 3, 4, 5 years down the road, if you have some sort of connection to the organization through this alumni group, I think it's easier. It's not a slam dunk, but you have a better chance of people knowing what your skill set is, and then when that part-time opens up, to slide you in there versus going externally, which costs a whole bunch more money, and trying to recruit.
Yeah, and very similarly to Marilyn, part of what we've done is what we call personal pursuits program. So first, hopefully, as we roll out mass career customization, there's more options for making a choice that's not so binary, I have to stay or go. But then the goal of personal pursuits is that you can take up to a 5-year leave. And, for instance, if you're in our audit business, keeping your professional licensure is very important. So we'll pay for you to keep that licensure. We'll invite you to all the office events so you stay in the network. And so you're even more closely connected than you are through our alumni network, which is very similar to what Accenture does. So there's lots of connection points. And so we found through that, then, we do get a lot of boomerangs returning to our organization after a period of time. But, and I'm actually at that point where I've been out of business school. My kids are 9 and 12. A lot of my colleagues in business school are now at that point where maybe they've been out 8, 9 years, haven't really stayed connected or stayed current. And that can be, you know, for the individual, an uphill battle. I mean, I think there's a point at which it's the individual has to take some ownership to update their skills and get themselves connected again as well. So that, because you're always looking for that win-win. You know, there's got to be a win for the organization. There's got to be a win for the individual. That's one of our guiding principles in mass career customization is it's not sustainable if it's all about the individual or it's all about the organization. Now, it may be different at different moments in time. It may be a little tilted, but there's got to be something there for both. And then I think when you see that there is, it really works very well.
And that flexibility going both ways is sort of a core tenet that I've seen successful with our full experience consultants. In fact, when Laura was asking the question from Genentech about when you're using technology, how do you, you know, limit it? When you have this results-based way and you talk about that flexibility goes both ways, so maybe the 32 hours, you know, isn't a structured 8 to 4 or whatever, because from a how work works, it can be a 24-hour, you know, availability, but when are you actually getting work done? When you let the consultant or individual employee figure out when it needs to get done because they know the results. The key is always that they have to know what's expected of them, you know, in a larger period of time, whether it's a month or a quarter or whatever, and then they can manage it within the technology that enables them to have a more fluid way of getting the results done. So that's how I see it.
England has had a program for years called Career Breaks, which is what we're discovering here. And I think one of the things that they've done there is people can return on a part-time basis. But they've also asked someone to mentor the person. So you leave, but you stay connected in the ways that you described.
Yep.
And that includes someone whose responsibility it is to stay connected with you. And I think that particularly helps at work.
So let's bring, and I want to do more Q&A because I know there's lots of questions. Let's bring it back to the beginning because a lot of the people in the audience are thinking about this in some stage of potentially either pitching it to their executive committee or implementing it within HR. What were the first steps that you guys took? What were the learnings that you can share with the audience just so that they can kind of get a mind around where do I start? Josh, you want to kick that off?
You know, and I feel like I'm in a good position to talk about it because our firm is in an embryonic stage with its flexibility policy. But I've also been advising clients in terms of developing their own policies. You know, we developed a task force of committed people to research this question. We retained a consultant to advise us. And this is my bit of self-promotion here. I think you have to consult a lawyer as well in terms of developing.
Absolutely.
When in doubt, call your lawyer, your favorite labor and employment lawyer. I'm quite serious because there are legal ramifications and legal landmines that you want to be aware of. Alternative work weeks. You know, we've been talking about exempt, non-exempt. I mean, there are some significant overtime issues here. As Ellen pointed out at the beginning, you know, when are we working? You have this ability with this flexible place to be able to work away from the job. Well, how are you accounting for that time? And are you being paid for that time? And, you know, a lot of these issues come up really need to be scrubbed out with your lawyers. There are other issues too in terms of workplace flexibility is a form of accommodation. We don't think about it maybe as an accommodation, but think about your obligations under the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, you've got an obligation to provide a disabled employee with a reasonable accommodation. Well, if you're providing non-disabled employees with sort of job restructuring and this sort of workplace flexibility, you can be sure that that is going to be, something that you need to consider for disabled employees as well. So there are a number of issues. If you're in a unionized environment, other issues to concern yourself with as well. The obligation to negotiate these kinds of changes with the labor union. So yes, it's self-promotion, but I'm also not really kidding. I mean, there's some important legal issues to consider, those are some.
That's a good starting.
In terms of first steps, I mean, the task force, the legal issues, and scrubbing some of those out, and
So Marilyn, did you guys start with the task force? And what would be the next step after you hire Josh?
Well, we have our attorney part of our task force. I would just say pilot first. And I think you've heard it here a few times, but you can get away with so much more if you call it a pilot. And the thing, I mean, if your group is resistant, I think that's a great way to dip your toe into these waters. The other thing that it does is it builds champions. And I think to your point, if you have a set of champions in the business who can speak to, I did it. I had great results. I mean, because there are a lot of people who are afraid that what if I offer this and everybody wants to take advantage of it and I'll have no one. And, you know, they're fantasizing about sitting alone at a cube or something. But the reality is that if you do pilots, and what we did was pilots in different countries so that we took into consideration different cultural aspects of it, so pilots in Asia, pilots in Europe, pilots in the U.S. in different areas, those people are our champions now. And now we have been able to form the task force to say, now let's put in place some of the policies that make these enterprise-wide. But we have an easier road since we have these champions in the business.
Excellent. So you've got your pilot. Tim, can you build on that?
Well, executive buy-in is critical here. And obviously, the business case we've talked about, but you know, really getting the mind share around, you know, not an option, and yet it's an option about how we execute. And E&Y started this road with our People First initiative, which was right at the very top. Jim Turley, our chairman, said that we're not in the business necessarily of serving our clients. We're in the business of developing our people's careers. And as a little bit of a reality check here, when we talk about People First, when it initially rolled out, there were a lot of people that were using this as a crutch to ask for things that maybe weren't possible either from a lead time or from a reality of serving clients. And so the reality check became it's people first, but not you first. And so that was in the initial years. We've evolved past that a little bit. But that really served as the foundation for getting executives and for, you know, the top tiers of partners and the partners and the senior managers to really start to buy into the fact that I need to make business decisions with my team and with my people, with me as part of that decision-making process, rather than just a straight P&L type of a decision or something that doesn't consider the implications on our people. And flexibility is clearly one of those pieces that absolutely has to be baked into what our people are thinking and how they're operating and how they're serving their clients and how they're learning, developing their career. So people first, executive layer. That was where we started.
Great. Molly, any specific learnings as you guys did your pilots?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely echoing the idea that the business case is imperative. Build it, say it over and over again, never stop communicating it. Driving change from the top. The board of directors was very engaged very early on. There's a great story in the book about them really just challenging us to make it happen faster, faster, faster. But each of our implementation teams is led by a group of line leaders from that area of the organization in partnership with talent and HR, but driven through the organization. And one thing that hasn't been talked about, as you set up those implementation leadership teams, as you look for your executive sponsors and voices, make sure that those champions reflect the diversity of the segments of the organization you're trying to engage.
Great
so
point.
We've talked about how it cuts across both genders. The leadership, therefore, needs to do that. We've talked about how it speaks to the boomer generation as well as Gen X and Gen Y. Again, make sure that representation is there. The other thing that can make this more approachable that we've found is, again, the notion that, well, we haven't had a formal structured process the way that we're implementing now. Informally, this has been happening for quite some time. That hasn't necessarily been talked about a lot, but if you share the stories of how your leaders, of how people at different levels have built their careers and made it work with their life, it can be phenomenally powerful. It can add a lot of credibility and make it a lot less intimidating. So our chairman happens to be a woman, Sharon Allen. She shared her story. Our CEO, Barry Salzberg, he shared his story. Because, of course, we've all had different phases of our journey along the way, where we've been more or less focused on that particular career. And so that again lets people begin to see, oh, okay, this is possible, this has some credibility, because some of those very successful in the organization have also traveled this path. So we think that's another great lever.
And I guess I would say, don't do what we did. Start going back to the very beginning, because I think Accenture made some assumptions, and incorrect assumptions. And those assumptions were made by very smart people sitting in a dark room, sort of disconnected in many ways from what the people were wanting. And it was that sort of, the mantra is now the receiver defines the value, not the giver. And so you would have some of our leaders saying, or some of our people saying, well, I'm sure that everyone wants blah, 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 fill in the blank, flexibility, 4-day work week, blah, And so this stuff would be rolled out with, bad results, because people are going, no, that isn't what I want. So we actually went back to, step one, you ask the people, we did a survey, and that was how we found out, okay, pick the top two things that you want that you don't have in terms of flexibility. That was able to basically take this kind of shotgun approach down to a very laser focus that we could actually begin to impact. And when we found out that people were looking for career flexibility was one of those elements, then we could begin to target that, identify it, figure out the steps, work in focus groups, et cetera, and then take that piece of information, put a backdrop of what the U.S. trends are, so here's what the business case, the trends are, here's this element that we're looking at, and then we took it to a pilot. But I would say be sure you are not making assumptions.
Perfect. People, we always talk about you don't see the light unless you feel the heat, and the heat is not only talking to the people and knowing what it is that they want, but also you're so you really do need to customize it to your employees, but you also need to customize it to the business challenge that they're addressing. The general business case won't work. It needs to be your particular company's business case, and you need not only the expected champions, but the unexpected champions. Oh my God, the CFO is for this at IBM. They made the CFO their champion. I wanted to tell the story of how Merck has done this because I think it's interesting. They created constituency groups of different representatives of their workforce, and there was one on white men, which I think was very important. People of color, women, et cetera. And they had different levels of people representing them. And they had the question they were asked, what would make this a good place to work for people like you? And then what would make this company a good place for customers like you? So they took the customer and the employee focus in coming up with new ways to look at how they're going to change Merck. And obviously there's a compelling business reason, because the pharmaceutical industry has been having some challenges.
That's fantastic. The customer first is fantastic. I'm going to go to questions in just 1 second. There's like 80 hands up. The other critical flexibility initiative that I know a lot of companies have emailed me about is telework. So can anyone speak to specifically any strategies around telework as, it's becoming more popular? Any learnings around as you implemented it? Yeah. So telework is people working in their home or in a pod kind of way. So if you've got – Sun is very big on telework. In fact, they just released – for those of you who are looking for more data, they just released their iWork program survey results. And they basically found that they're reducing their carbon footprint as an employer. Their employees have much higher retention because they have satellite offices. So not every, and no one at Sun, I think, has a permanent office. You just go into any of the offices and there are – pods that you can sit at and get your work done, or you can work from home. So it's this this idea that you're a fluid person that has places that you can work, or you can choose to work from your home.
Well, Cisco's pushing the envelope on this one.
Okay.
So, and again, it's as a technology company has an advantage in that we are using our own technology. So that's a good thing. We get it at cost. So. But the Cisco story is that as we refurbish our buildings, because they're at the stage where we're starting to go building by building and refurbish them across all of our campuses, we build them with hoteling or common workspaces. And what's amazing to me, because I am a baby boomer, and I work and have an office and can actually close my door. So these are, they have offices in these areas, but they also have these open pods with desks that sort of are in a cluster. And I was dreading the fact that my building was going to get refurbished, and now I was going to have to be in this space because I like to have my photos and, you know, very baby boomer. So enough said. So the interesting thing for me is that many of our Gen Y workers who don't work in buildings that have this common space are going there to do their work. And the managers who are working in those buildings have been completely converted. They are now our best spokespeople for that kind of open situation. So it's a smaller carbon footprint. It allows and promotes collaboration. As long as you can do what I have to do, which is give up your personal pictures and stuff. Actually, everyone has locker spaces. They're common areas. If you visit some of the other companies in the Valley, like Google, they started that way. So for us, it's a conversion, and it is some change management, but it's absolutely delightful. And in other countries, they have screen shades that move across different areas. I mean, it's very, very interesting. There are even pods where you can go take a quick nap or rest, put on headphones, do things. So it recognizes the new ways that people are working, and everyone seems to love it.
And can I just say one thing about that? And this is sort of a piece of research. Accenture started hoteling, I would say, probably 7 years ago, sort of as a, is this going to work? And you would have thought the world was going to end because everyone went from this kind of bricks to more of the hoteling. You fly in, you leave, you know, whatever. It's really interesting. I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and we had one of our tech people come in and say, you know what? Here's how it's impacting what you do, Sharon. We believe in the next 5 years that even all of our people who are using laptops right now, 50% of them are going to go to PDAs or a whole different time if even the technology in laptops is going to be so versatile. And the impact of that is in the next 3 to 5 years, Accenture has $760 million worth of research of real estate leases coming up for renewal. So now we're at this kind of convergence of technology, research costs, even with our hoteling, and the way people live and work. And how are we going to be smart about making assumptions or not making assumptions on this enormous amount of millions of dollars that we're going to have to think differently about, too?
Fantastic.
I don't have an answer.
Okay, right there in the middle. So the question is, do you have a way where employees can have a flexible work environment in their home? Do you maybe furnish it? Do you... Okay.
I can start with a one-second answer. Yes, we make sure that they have some ergonomic information, and if they need to buy a chair or something that truly keeps them out of our medical bucket because now they have back problems.
Preventative is better than restorative.
Problems and vision problems. So we truly are ergonomically, I think, really trying to focus people on what's really good for you in terms of safety and also security of data. So if you have a two-year-old who likes to put, you know, peanut butter sandwiches in your hard drive, you know, that's probably not a good idea. So there's really a checklist. So I would say that's probably for us it's been working.
Yeah, I wanted to say that a number of companies are giving employees an allowance, like Capital One, I believe, gives you, maybe making this up, it's in the book, but $1,000 if you're going to furnish a home, you know, or a certain set amount if you're going to furnish a home office. One of the things that Arizona, as a part of their statewide initiative for When Work Works, do is that they, to the winners, they raffle off home office makeovers. Here are the things, though, that you need to look out for when you need to know that someone can be independent, can work, can take initiative, can work in this way, so it's not necessarily for everyone. I've seen companies make terrible mistakes when they announce to everyone that they will be teleworkers, and the baby boomers flipped out, and or people who thought that they were going to be next fired flipped out. So there needs to be some element or process about choice in doing this.
You need to have built-in ways for connecting. The people who telecommute need to say when they're going to be accessible and when they're not, because sometimes people can be reluctant to call them if they know that they're working at home. On our website, we've got tips for managers. It's just free, and everything is free on our website. We've got tips for managers for how to think about what the responsibilities are, and tips for employees if you're going to request this sort of thing. Another obstacle, and this is to Josh and the legal issues, is if you're in a tri-state area or in a two-state area that people are telecommuting, there are tax laws that can mitigate telecommuting, because you might be paying taxes on both your home where you live and where you work, and that's something that I think needs reform in Washington.
Yeah, I loved working up in Seattle. Lowered my taxes. Okay, in the blue.
Can I just tell you about one really cool one? It's a company. It's not in this year's book, but it was in last year's book. It's called ARUP. It's a blood bank in Salt Lake City. And when they asked the people, to Sharon's point, what they wanted to work full steam ahead, and then they wanted a real block of time off. So they created a 7-day on and 7-day off process. They're a 24/7 operation. And what they did was you work 4 days in 1 week and 3 days in the next week so that you're in compliance with the Fair Labor Standard Act. And then you have your 7 days off that cross 2 weeks and then, you know, come back again. So you're in compliance with the Fair Labor Standard Act, but you have a chunk of time that you're working and a chunk of time that you're not. IKEA did this, I saw it 20 years ago in Sweden, but anyway, companies are reinventing it here. Sorry?
You need to hire Josh.
No, you're right. I mean, to establish the alternative work week, there's a secret ballot election and all of that. I mean, when you're talking about a discrete work unit. But a discrete work unit may be a single individual employee. So there are those legal challenges.
You need to build it in to whatever you do. IBM has an initiative called Making IBM Small Again, because 43% of their workforce doesn't work in IBM offices. So you have to not only build it in on a daily basis if people are going to work, on a weekly basis or some regular basis so that people actually see each other or connect, whether it's through telepresence or whether it's through real-life connections, and then think about how to keep the culture that's so important to your culture, IBM. It's called Making IBM Small Again.
Tim, did you have anything with that when you guys rolled it out in the Northwest?
Well, some of this has come down to just how we define flexibility. And really, it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. Don't project your definition of flexibility on me. And the key is one of our phrases in our definition. I'll read it here just so I read it correctly. Apply professional maturity and take responsibility for outcomes. Suspend judgment about personal and client priorities. So this face-to-face need, particularly in the professional services world, varies by your client. And you need to be able to understand that particular client's need. Use your professional experience, your judgment, to say, I need to be here in front of you today to have a conversation so that we can share that moment. Or are there situations where we can accomplish work, get the outcomes accomplished, define what those expectations are, and not necessarily see each other for weeks at a time? Again, it comes down to communication, and that's why we use Fierce and our team acceleration to help those conversations and manage those expectations.
The other thing I would add to that is the Best Buy results-only work environment. For those of you who aren't familiar, we had them as a speaker last year. And that was a culture that's similar to what you're talking about, where it's a large, corporate office where everyone came in and they did this, we're not going to ask for management approval, and they just started piling in it, took charge without executive approval and started doing it. And their approach was, professionals can figure out when they need to get together in team and when they need to work by themselves. And they use the analogy of college. When you can skip class and you know when you can't. So that basically that they took that attitude of, if you tell them again from a results perspective what needs to get accomplished, then the individuals can decide when do they need to collaborate as a team and when do they have independent work. And they can figure it out themselves without someone telling them
when to show up and what to do.
I want to put a plug in for collaboration tools and the shift of physical spaces to more collaborative workspaces. Because I think when you actually diagnose, what people are doing and how much of their time is spent collaborating, we find that more time is spent collaborating. So our workplace resources folks have told us about other companies that have put together buildings that are tons of collaborative space. They redo the cafeterias or the cafes to be collaborative work areas that happen to also have food, like a Starbucks concept, where people are getting together informally to work together. But I think, you know, aside from Cisco's collaboration tools, there are plenty of them out there. Instant message chats, instant message with video chats, and I'm not talking expensive telepresence type technology, but the little eyeball cameras. For those who still need to have that closer connection, collaborative tools where you're all sharing the screens and things like that, they do become second nature if you start playing with them, and then you can reconfigure your campuses to be also more opportunities for collaboration. I know most of the traditional workplaces have very few conference rooms that are all booked, and then a lot of cubes that are all empty. So it's shifting that our mindset to say, how would we promote collaboration?
That's a great point. Thank you. Okay, right here. So for public entities and unionized environments, I know maybe Ellen, this is probably better for you since you know some of the more national trends.
Unions have been in some ways reluctant to, because they fought so hard, understandably, for full-time work, and they're worried about an erosion of what they've fought so hard for. So, but unions are very good in other ways, like unionized environments have a lot better benefits and a lot more protections for people. I think the notion that we've been describing, though, is at the root of unionism, and which is a collaborative discussion, a problem-solving discussion where the worker has a voice that can be heard. And the best example, one of the best examples that I've seen of union leadership on this is the notion of health and safety committees that so many unions have to create a work life or work family or whatever you want to call it committee where issues that come up that might involve someone being fired or getting a warning or seniority problems or so forth are brought to this committee. It's the same as if you'll ask the people, they'll know, kind of a principle. People have come up with very creative solutions through the work-life committees that I've seen in union. The Oil and Chemical and Atomic Workers was the first one that piloted that. Clue was a very early leader in taking up this issue. Government actually has done a lot more with telework than most organizations. The Women's Bureau, I know that there are people here from the Women's Bureau, has been a leader in particularly looking at entrepreneurs and how they're using flexibility right now. We did the first pamphlet on flexibility for the Women's Bureau in the mid-'80s, so this has been an issue, particularly of the Women's Bureau, a lot of resources on their website on flexibility. And who's here from the union? So she's. You want to say anything? I shouldn't be representing you. You should be representing yourself.
Great. So there was an earlier question, too, that was submitted to me about participation rates. So mass career customization is everyone's participating.
Yes, everyone participates.
For the other firms, what's the participation rate of how many people are involved in the flexibility programs as a percentage of your workforce? Anybody know their data? Guesstimate?
Like a formal, flexible work option, so reduced work schedule or telework, it's about 5% of our workforce.
And so, you expect that to grow?
So see, not everyone demands it.
Okay.
Well, if we're talking about informal telecommuting, probably over 80% of our folks do that some part of the week. So we haven't measured a lot of the other programs because we're just formalizing them now. So I don't know about them, but over 80% of our folks work up to 12 hours at home a week.
And that's Cisco.
Here's actually shameless self-promotion. When our new national study of the changing workforce comes out in 2008, we have asked a nationally representative group of employees what they have access to, what they use, and if they don't use it, why or why not. And we're asking them, do they want it? So we're looking at supply and demand and use on, I can't remember, but 17 kinds of flexibility, some number like that. So we will actually have nationally representative data to answer that question because we've been asked so often, and I've been saying, I don't know.
We all need data. Molly, from a rollout perspective, how much have you rolled out mass career customization at Deloitte?
We've implemented for 7,500 people, which is about 20% of our U.S.-based employee group, and we're in the middle of rolling out to 33,000 employees, many of whom are in the U.S. and some of whom are located in India right now. And some of the global member firms of the organization, such as the Netherlands and Australia and France, have also started implementations up. Many of them are in the pilot phase because they're lagging the U.S. a little bit.
So when will full implementation be done in the U.S.?
In the U.S., most employees will be in by the end of this year, maybe all. There may be a few groups that go in the following year.
Great. And Sharon, do you know your participation stats?
I would say that ours, because we issue everyone a laptop at the beginning of their life with Accenture, is probably close to 90%, and that's not formal. That is, do you work at home when you need to? Do you work at a client? Can you come to the office when you want to? So I would say ours is very unstructured, but over the course of a year, the majority of our workforce uses it.
And Josh, you guys know, you just formalized it in February.
We just formalized it. There are a handful of people who have taken advantage of it when it was informal, and I expect that number to grow.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's the good news for the audience who is just thinking about implementing is everyone's on their own journey, and these are the progressive leaders, so you're right in there with them. Questions? Yeah. Well, the green, actually, that is actually why Sun released their iWork information. This is a very low carbon footprint approach. Right.
In order to reduce commute time.
We are going to post on our website some of the creative things that companies are doing to deal with the gas crisis. So any of you who have things that your company does that you would like to, it's a way of sharing and people learning from each other, please email them to us. Our website is on the book that we gave you.
I like the she.
Mm-hmm. We do that.
Fantastic. Other questions? You've had your hand up. So the question is, when implementing flexibility globally, specifically within Asia, how do you manage that when work weeks can be up to 80 hours a week?
Well, the good news for us is one of our the pilot that we did in Asia was because the executive who is in charge of Asia very much wanted to put a flexibility program in place. So we did the pilot there. The only thing that I would say is you have to deal with every country's different legal issues. And so you're completely right. Shameless promotion for my colleague over here. You really have to check what the laws are in each country. We were fortunate. I think one of the things that was helpful was during the epidemic in China, we were one of the few countries that didn't have to shut down because we had our employees work from home. And we then were able to tell that story to other companies in China, and it helped us increase our business. So remember the SARS epidemic?
Yep.
We were one of the few organizations that went business as usual because everyone could work from home. And so I think we crossed that bridge early on. So we have a lot of receptivity in terms of general flexibility. We've had one challenge with a job share situation. An employee wanted to do a job share. The manager didn't think that was really anything that we could possibly do. So we left that up to that same executive to say, make a decision, and if it's okay with you, we'll help that manager get over the hurdle, and that's what we did. So we saved that employee who was going to leave if they couldn't get into a flexible work week. So we haven't had a challenge with it.
Well, and the distributed workforce is also something that came out of 9/11. I know a lot of Wall Street firms were hit by the fact that everyone was in an environment. So from a data recovery, from ability to service your clients, from a safety perspective, the distributed workforce has been a strategy for lots of good reasons. Other questions?
Can I answer the one thing about the Asian countries, which is it varies, of course, depending on the country. But one of the if you go to Japan, the first thing that they tell you when you get off the plane is the birth rate. When you go to Singapore, the first thing that they tell you is 2.4, now 2, you know, 1.4, 1.3, whatever the birth rate is. And that has been a very compelling reason for at least some countries in Asia to pay a lot of attention to flexibility because their population is aging, the birth rate is low in also a number of countries in Europe. And in the Nordic countries, which have long had much more flexibility than other parts of the world, they do not have the lower birth rates that other parts of the world do, and people are beginning to learn from each other's global experience.
Absolutely. So the question for the podcast, because there are people in the back, how do we allow people to come in and out for maternity backfills, do part-time, job share, as other strategies to fill in, during your ups and downs of workload?
I think it depends on how each company measures their FTEs, is full-time equivalent, or they measure to dollars. So at Cisco, we're in a transition where most groups are managing to the dollars. So what you do is you can bring in a contractor, you can bring in a part-time person. It really doesn't matter. It's just a dollar situation. The dollars available might equal 10 FTE, or it might equal 15 or 20, depending on how you want to work it with part-time, full-time people. So I wouldn't see it as an issue. I think it's not an issue at all if someone wants to go part-time. And I think you're coming up with a creative solution before a person leaves, whether it's a person taking a leave of absence or leaving because they're ready to retire. We're looking at phased retirement programs for people who want to cut back 2 years prior to their actual retirement date. And how would you leverage that knowledge, and how would you balance them with someone else who's coming in to do the work? So it's the knowledge transfer you're talking about in the situation of a temporary thing.
Yeah, and I think in general the framework that I'm hearing from the panelists is part-time work, flexible work, work that's based on results instead of face time is actually what they're proposing. So the strategies on the how are I think, going to be individual based on the culture and what's expected of the business.
Yeah, and part of what we're after in mass career customization is that it's a dynamic and continual process. That is, somebody might be at 60% for 3 months. Somebody might want to then go up to 80%. That you're always touching base, and as the needs of all the different players in that part of the organization are changing, what the right way to configure the work at that moment in time is what you're kind of always evaluating, so that you're able to have it be less static, people aren't locked into one set of circumstances, and that you are getting that future planning going. Because so much of what happens now is the crisis or the in the moment. I remember well the year that we had 92 pediatrician visits, ear infections all year, no sleep. What am I going to do now? I'm in the middle of this crisis. How will I get through? And to really be able to get that longer-term element, because managers and teams can be more effective with that.
And let's just end on, what are the new things? Actually, this is for you. What are the new strategies that you have on the horizon for Accenture, and I think EY has more?
We have a couple of them. We have just created a flexible transitions, which is, I think it was alluded to, similar to personal pursuits, where we keep people, I think, connected longer and better. We have something that we're starting in September called Gradual Return to Work, which is for every mom who goes out. She has a safety net of 8 weeks where she can come in and basically tell us what works for her. if she wants to travel, if she doesn't want to travel, she wants to work 3 days a week, and if we don't have a place for her and we have to put her on the bench, that's fine. She'll stay there for 8 weeks. So it's really being a very customized approach. I think the other thing as far as flexibility is we're looking at a program called Stop the Clock for some of our executives who are or people who are continuing. You know, we've basically got this up or out mentality in some of our areas of the workforce. You know, if you have a year and you just know you have other things on your mind, whether it's fighting cancer with a family member or a very sick child or whatever, is there a way that you can kind of take a year of your career and have it not count toward that kind of up or out mentality? So I think gradual return to work, stop the clock, and we're also looking at a parent partnering program where an employee, before she has a baby and comes back, would have sort of a mentor to help think about what do I need to be smarter about my scheduling and just basic survival, not only when I'm going out but coming back.
Fantastic. And for us, mass career customization is obviously a big focus. And once it rolls out, you're not done because it's an enterprise transformation. As many of you know, the need to reinforce and continue to drive it deeper into your organization will take a couple of years for us. But it's part of a larger talent experience. And I think a lot of what we've heard today is things like different ways to connect and come together virtually. So we've rolled out a social networking tool within the organization so that all kinds of communities of people can locate each other and connect, building in the kinds of rituals and places where you can come together physically, because that connection becomes very precious. So investing in an education center where people can come together, redesigning our offices through Workplace of the Future so that those are more community and collaborative spaces. We've had hoteling for a while, but what's the next level we can go to? So that all of those things then come together to reinforce each other and work together. And connecting those disparate programs into an integrated whole so that they're all working together is a big focus for us.
Any other words of advice from our panelists as we close up? Josh, one more plug.
I think, you know, again, Nixon Peabody is, we're taking baby steps.
Yeah.
And but we're taking them. And I think that you know, you have to have the confidence in your team and in your ability to grow. And that's what we've done, and I would encourage you to do the same.
Any other advice?
I just had one more point. It's really interesting because Accenture's average age now is 34. It's been 34 for a while. So, okay, read the writing on the wall. We are nearly thinking completely differently about how we communicate with our people about all of these things, about flexibility, nearly creating, in fact, we are an internal Facebook. Because if you think of how the boomers think about technology and how Gen Y thinks about technology, it's completely different. And flexibility being woven with technology, Facebook, all of these different elements are really being front and center. So we're exploring that, and you might want to think of the same. Keep in mind kind of the age of your folks.
Excellent.
I guess the other thing that I would say for us is that we really have to look at how our managers manage. And so this is managing a different way for some people. And we recognize that coupled with these programs and in order to help them be successful, we have to roll out some additional support in the form of managerial training to get managers to be able to understand how to manage in this new environment. So I would just say, I not only do I wish all of you luck, but please, all of you, wish us luck as our journey continues.
Absolutely. Ellen?
I think that a next step is to see talent management as a life cycle issue and including all employees, not just top talent, but the lower wage employees whom we were talking about, and that everybody needs competency in managing his or her own talent and in managing each other's talent. And middle managers have been, for a long time, the forgotten peg in all of this. If the middle manager feels that it's going to be more work for me or doesn't know how to deal with a Gen Y's demand or whatever,
then it's not going to work. And so we really need to make sure that people who are not at the top and not at the bottom, but also in the middle, are benefiting from this as well as learning new ways of managing. And so that's what I would see as the wave of the future.
Fantastic. Well, we're so thrilled that you were able to come. We wanted to make sure that you saw a great overview of different strategies from top firms who are really thinking about this in a progressive way. We hope you got some specific learnings. We'd love for you to stay in touch. Let us know what you saw as actionable, what you're going to do tomorrow, how does it work. This is an ongoing dialogue, really a community of best practices is going to grow from this every year. And I'll make a plug for Foresight, because when we're talking about, you know, how do managers manage in this new way, that's exactly what Christine does. So, you know, we're resources here to try and enable, you know, you to be successful in what you're trying to achieve. This is a business solution. You know, it is the future of work. So I also wanted to say, to enable flexible work, our panelists, as a thank you in our keynote, will receive a flexible messenger bag from Timbuktu. And you get to custom design it. I'll get custom careers. So Timbuktu is one of our favorite clients, and they're hip. They build in San Francisco. They make these. And you can design your own colors, because this matches my purse, not yours. As a thank you for taking your time and sharing your fantastic information, we really appreciate it. Thank you so much.